Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
So let me ask you this question, Shane, because it's an interesting observation. What do you suspect you'll have to adjust to going back, if you're going back? Going back, what do you expect that experience to be like? As you think, I mean, you're still a little ways away from it, but still.
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to be like. I will take a huge adjustment. It's a different world, mm-hmm. where evangelicalism is a minority, mm-hmm. and church is done differently, mm-hmm. in a minority setting. I think it's a lot tighter. Mm-hmm. People tend to be active in their faith, mm-hmm. by virtue of them even going to a church. Mm-hmm. It becomes expected for them to be active like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't really foresee how I can. I don't know. I don't know what to expect, really, going back. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really don't.
Mm-hmm. Here's a problem that some people face, and maybe I'm asking it ahead of time. Maybe we need to, you know, do this in 5 years after you've graduated, yeah. and gone back. But do you anticipate an adjustment being that now that you've seen a variety of things and what's possible, mm-hmm. And thinking about going back and doing some of those things, yeah. what the reaction might be? Do you anticipate, and is there ever any sense, would you ever have a sense of saying, well, they'll react to that because they'll think I'm just trying to do something American rather than doing,
yeah.
something Christian.
The American coming back, yeah. wanting to change everything.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
My home churches back in Ireland are very much excited that I'm here in Dallas, mm-hmm. and they're eager for Katie and I to come back and to get involved, mm-hmm. in church life. Mm-hmm. I don't really have any grand visions of changing everything when I go, mm-hmm. back. I think I'm a pretty realistic person, really. Mm-hmm. I just want to take the excellent teaching and instruction that I've been getting here and use that in a way that's beneficial. Maybe I might start an adult Sunday school class. I don't know.
You've said that a few times.
I like it. I really do. Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, interesting. Cesar, what do you think?
Yes, in Venezuela, most of the Protestant churches are Pentecostals, and mm-hmm. most of them are prosperity gospel. Mm-hmm. So if when I go back, I would like to start a church that is more biblically based, mm-hmm. and perhaps also incorporating some of the things I've learned in the church in the U.S., the small groups, the Sunday school, mm-hmm. things that we usually don't do over there. So and I think that change for a person who comes from the Catholic background to go to a Presbyterian church would be much less. They would feel more at home than, mm-hmm. going to the Pentecostal churches where they're more vocal, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let me. This question comes to mind. You know, American culture is very individualistic. It's particularly when it comes to churches, at least in the Dallas area, I tell people you can get whatever kind of church you want. You can, sure. get a Jack in the Box church, you can get a, mm-hmm. McDonald's church, you can get a Subway church, you can get Quiznos, you can get it in any kind of variety, and you also have this individualistic thing going on. Is there a difference in how a corporate group is seen in the cultures that you live in? In other words, is there a different kind of mentality about being a part of a group versus being an individual? And how does that work itself out? Mikhail, I'll start with you.
I think especially in the church, there's loyalty not only to your church, but to your youth group, let's say, mm-hmm. or to your small group, that they're part of everybody's lives, mm-hmm. Far more than would be at work, let's say, where you're part of a department. Mm-hmm. With church, that group identity is so important to them. So much so that in some cases there's actually some animosity between like other churches, mm-hmm. you know, like one mega church versus another mega church, mm-hmm. kind of a thing, and they're making some efforts at unity, but it's in a collectivistic communalistic culture, there's definitely that loyalty to the group, and your identity is in that
and
group.
And Filipinos are structured that way. Are they more corporate, generally speaking,
yes,
than Indian?
Definitely.
So whereas in the United States, you might say, well, I choose to be a part of this youth group. And the identity, when it flips, is, no, if I'm going to make sense of who I am, I need to be a part of this group. This is part of what it is to be a person. It flips in that kind of way. Now Europe's kind of an interesting culture in that regard. It's kind of a little bit of a mix. I've lived in Scotland and in Germany, Scotland for 3 years and Germany for four. And it does strike me that Europeans, generally speaking, do have there's a bigger corporate dimension to the way they view things. But there also is a heavy individualism that has always fueled what's going on in Europe, because that's actually where the individualism came from that fueled what happened in the United States. So how does that play? Does that play itself out at all in Ireland, in the corporate versus individual thing, or not?
Yeah, I think you're evangelical in Ireland is primarily thinking of himself as part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think that. Because you are, in a sense, removing yourself from a large section of the population when you do make a stand as a evangelical Christian. And so there's no way, I think, you could survive without that community. It becomes necessary for your spiritual life. It's not so much as a thing of enjoyment or a thing of reinforcing yourself.
It's not a consumer choice.
It's not a consumer choice.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a matter of survival that you would seek out community.
Mm-hmm.
If you're living in the west of Ireland, I know people that drive for hours to go to a local evangelical church because they realize that if they are not doing that, they are very much on their own. And so it becomes essential to your spiritual life. I don't think you can foresee yourself apart from that.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to realize that in Christian communities where there may be one church of choice, in a large area, it's a completely different experience than the church on every corner where you can pick and choose what kind of you have to make it work,
right.
And differences have to be sorted out and that kind of thing because there is, in one sense, no other place to go.
Yeah.
And so that does something to the dynamic of what happens in the community, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it reinforces unity.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, I think people are more inclined to work through issues rather than go to the church down the street because there isn't one.
Yeah. And I suspect that for some people listening to us who've grown up in American Christianity, particularly if they've grown up in the South where you do have all those choices and all those options, to think about a Christianity that functions that way would be to think of in a completely different kind of context to operate in.
Yeah.
Very, very different than what they're used to. Cesar, what do you say?
Yeah, Latin Americans are very much family-oriented and community-oriented, so most people would live most of their lives in the same city. There's not that high mobility as there is here in the U.S. So for someone to go from the Catholic Church to a Protestant Church, that's a really big change because you won't be praised for that. You'll be probably ridiculed, and so Christians there tend to be very much genuine Christians.
Mm-hmm.
There are not many nominal Christians over there, so they're sometimes rejected by their families, and so it's a big deal to be a Christian.
Now, that's another dimension of this that is, if I can say, context dependent. It seems to me that because I have a very close friend who's Guatemalan who teaches school at Denver. In fact, we're going to have him on a podcast related to the discussion on immigration that we're going to be doing. And he also came out of a Catholic background. His parents were Catholic, and he became a Protestant. And the tension between the Catholic Church and the Protestants in Latin America is a completely different kind of experience than what you get sometimes in Europe. And so maybe that's another part of the discussion we ought to have. What is it like to move from the Catholic Church to a Protestant church in Latin America?
Well, first of all, you don't have many buildings. You have to meet in houses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. You really don't have a place to meet. So First of all, finding a church is hard. It's not as easy as here in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Second, your family will not understand what you're doing. Why are you doing this? You were baptized Catholic. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? And in your work, you will be ridiculed because most evangelicals are on the lower classes, so mm-hmm. mostly uneducated. So you'll be kind of labeled as an uneducated person. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, people like to have evangelicals work for them because they know they're honest people. Hmm. So they have this double
double approach yes. to the question. Huh? Yes. Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Now, how about in Ireland in relationship to the Catholics? I mean, now, again, I'm going to reflect a little bit about our experience. But when we were in Scotland and we were in Germany both, with so many... With such a pervasive secular culture, yeah. if I can say it that way, yeah. the very fact that Catholics believed in God, talked about Jesus, mm-hmm. that kind of thing made a difference. And at least where I was, you didn't sense the degree of tension that my Latin American friend felt in right. Protestants and Catholics going on in Latin America. Was that true in Ireland?
It
as
is
well?
True now. I mean, it was different.
Yeah, sure.
40 years ago.
I know the history. Of
yeah,
Northern
now
Ireland,
it's
sure.
now it's completely different. I mean, and I think it is secularism. It's completely people are not really concerned about the theological differences between denominations. Mm-hmm. That's largely irrelevant for most Irish people. Mm-hmm. They just know that you are an evangelical and that might be perceived as strange, but they're not antagonistic towards you, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. They just see it as something that you're into, or you know, that's mm-hmm. just your choice, but they're not going to be perceiving you as a threat or as, you know, someone to persecute.
Now, evangelicals are I take it from listening to you that evangelicals are such a minority in Ireland yeah. that their ability to coalesce, say, around social issues with Catholics, that's barely negligible as a factor. Is that true?
I mean, the 2011 census, people that returned the census form as evangelical were 0.09% of the population.
Wow.
I mean, so yeah. you can't really say that we are to the forefront of social issues because it's tiny. I mean, there are very many people in the Republic of Ireland that probably don't know any evangelical Christians, or, you know, mm-hmm. they probably don't have any evangelical Christian friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's different in other parts of the country, but it is a tiny minority, definitely.
That's a staggering number, because that reminds me of stories I've heard about, like, Christians in Turkey and places like that, where they're only, I mean, I know in Turkey at one point here recently, there were only two people who had the equivalent of an MDiv degree yeah. ministering in Turkey. I mean, so it's you know, you could count. I think at one point it was 200 out of 80 million. Okay, it was just, which makes your thing looks like church growth.
Yeah.
But still, it's yeah. you know, that's an incredible. Now that situation has changed. The church there is growing, but it's interesting when the group is that small, what the dynamic is, and you can see why it would be driven towards a kind of community.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I have no idea, because like I said, I've never been to the Philippines, what it's like in the Philippines. What's the Catholic evangelical relationship like in the Philippines?
I think for most people, they see the two as, apart from Islam, the two major religions, mm-hmm. seeing them as different religions. Mm-hmm. So much so that for a Protestant who would come out of a Catholic background, mm-hmm. What they would struggle with, what my dad struggled with, was this feeling that he had somehow rejected the family mm-hmm. tradition, mm-hmm. rejected the family structure. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that everybody does mm-hmm. that you won't be participating in mm-hmm. as a Protestant. And so the question then is, they struggle with, did I do the right thing? I want to follow Jesus, but... you know, am I going to be rejected for it? And so there's that struggle. And what my dad would say to his family is, have I gotten further away from God by doing this? Mm. You know, how have I gotten further away from God by mm-hmm. by becoming a Protestant? And so, yeah, they're almost seen as different religions, and there's very little, if any, working together there.
Now, so you all come out of this kind of mixed bag of backgrounds mm-hmm. With very different experiences overseas from what you're experiencing here. What combination of values do you hope to bring to your ministry? In other words, given the fact that you've got this mixed pedigree mm-hmm. In terms of your training and experience, what would you hope to take with you into ministry that is a reflection of the combination of experiences that you've had, Cesar?
Well, certainly time management for me has been a big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the first things that my mentor here told me is you have to do a time management. You have due dates. You have to. So that's a big thing because time over there is relative. Mm-hmm. So that would be something important for me. And in terms of my ministry, I would say the depth of teaching that you get here at Dallas Seminary is something that is lacking over there. The teachings over there tend to be very superficial because, as I said, pastors are not very academically prepared. So I think this depth of teaching would be something I would bring that would be very helpful.
So now when you think about, again, this is kind of like the question I asked Shane earlier. So when you bring an element of time management to Latin America, what in the world is that going to look like? That's
revolutionary, I think. You would have to adapt. Obviously, you wouldn't be able to do it as well as you do it here. But
just
I think
be glad you're not a German bringing time in. Yes.
I think it would be bring some more efficiency to my ministry.
So that's what you've gained from it, is seeing how it makes you more more effective in some ways.
Yes.
I see. So. Shane?
I don't know about values, but I mean, like Cesar was saying, the training and the teaching that I'm being equipped with, that's something I really want to bring back mm-hmm. and share with the church. And that's something that they're excited that I would bring back. Mm-hmm. But I mean, these are things that that Christians all over the world share in common. I mean, every Christian right. wants to grow in their theology. Right. I mean, that's not something that I need to instill in my Irish brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. They have a desire mm-hmm. and a passion, but there just isn't that legacy and that heritage of evangelical seminaries in Ireland. And mm-hmm. so being here is not so much a different value that I'm getting, it's more being able to fulfill that desire that I've had for many years and something that my church has encouraged me to pursue. Mm-hmm. And so bringing something like teaching back to the church would not be seen as a revolutionary thing, but a welcome gift, I think.
Now, I haven't asked you this question, but have you, either of you, been back to your home since you came here as students?
Yeah, I go back every 2 months as mm-hmm. I practice surgery over there. Oh. And it's sometimes very shocking when I go there and I compare what I'm living here. So, uh-huh. In everywhere, just well, we had a good standard of living there, but the country in general doesn't. Mm-hmm. And when I go to church, I feel that I could be much more useful once I've learned all that I've learned here. Yeah. Like, I'm in class and I'm blown away by what I'm learning by such gifted teachers here.
Yeah.
And Shane, have you been
back? I haven't been back yet, but I'm going to be heading back this summer. My brother is getting married, so
congratulations.
Be a great family event.
Yeah,
so I'm going to spend some time in England. He's getting married in England, and then I'm going to spend some time back in Ireland. Yeah. So hopefully I get to meet my friends and spend some time at my church. Yeah,
because I do think one of the hard adjustments that students who do come here have when they come here and they've been exposed to our culture mm-hmm. is going back, and there's almost a reculturalization. Now, the fact that you've been able to go back regularly and stay in touch with your culture while you've been here is probably going to be terrifically helpful to you.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Mikkel, I know you live here and you don't, and you were a missionary in the wild for the Philippines, and you've been back here in the States for some time?
Yes.
And now, do you have any family still in the Philippines?
Yeah, my parents are there and all my brothers.
I see. So do you ever go back or do you? I have not
been back since 2006 when we were missionaries.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you've been away for some time. Yeah. Now you did do the reentry thing where you had grown up in your cultural context, you'd come to the States and you'd gone back and you went back to in ministry. So what was that like? Did that require some adjustments or?
Oh yeah, definitely. one thing that was very different was being an adult versus mm-hmm. being a kid.
Yeah.
Because when you're a kid, if there's a problem, it's your parents' problem. Put on your Walkman and press play on, listen to your cassettes. All those cassettes that were there. Yeah. but now as an adult, you had to deal with all of life as an adult there. When we were doing our worldview training, one of the things that I was able to take back with me from the apologetics training that I got at Biola was really looking at worldview and seeing how in this city we had just a backdrop of religious pluralism where there's people involved in everything. There's Chinese immigrants who are practicing Chinese traditional religions. There are people who are both, you say you're a business person and you're opening a new building. You may have a priest come bless it. You may have a feng shui master come in later on, and you know all along
what
down
was
the
that
line.
You said or what?
A feng shui master.
A feng shui master. What is
that? Chinese geomancy to make sure that everything is oriented just so, so that positive energy can be manipulated and flow through the place.
Oh wow! Okay.
And so there's a lot of this. I'll take whatever from whoever.
Yeah.
And that's part of the animistic background. As well as, you know, if I'm going to get some prosperity, then it doesn't really matter who it comes from. Mm-hmm. I'll just cover all my bases.
I see.
So they would say, and that's one thing that Christians struggle with, actually. Evangelicals will say, in my business, we're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then their employees might say, well, what do we have to lose?
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Mm.
So taking back some of those kind of worldview training kinds of things was very helpful to them. It was helpful to me also to see where is the person coming from when they ask such a question. What are the presuppositions that they're bringing to the table? So also theological training, there's sometimes some pushback against that in the Philippines. As one Filipino author put it, talking about American missionaries, let them take the Bible apart and put it back together again like Lego. We're going to dance and make art. So there was this kind of distinction between doing an academic scholarly study of the text and just, you know, living real life, quote unquote. So being able to bridge that gap and show how we can love God with everything that we are, with our mind, with our intellect, our emotions, and everything that we are.
So are there syncretistic problems in Venezuela? I know there are in Guatemala. So his mentioning the Philippines made me think about that.
Yes. Now we've become very close to Cuba, and many of the indigenous religions from Cuba have come to Venezuela, Santeria. So there's a lot of spiritism, and that, and people, Catholic people, they don't see anything wrong with practicing that and belonging to the Catholic Church. So there is a lot of syncretism there.
See, that's another thing that's interesting that we haven't had time to discuss. I'm not sure if we still do, but there are issues that take place in the context that you all live in that don't show up or tend not to show up here. If I were to raise that category, what types of things do you find yourself facing as a Christian, just thinking about it automatically in some cases, that tend not to be on the radar screen of issues that you would find if you were operating in the churches that you're now participating in? Probably the least radical difference, although I think there would be some, would be what you might face in Ireland. But do you think, is anything leap to mind about?
Well, before I came to DTS, I was working in Cork City, just in a secular job. And I was surprised that one thing I had to defend over and over again was the historical lineage of evangelicalism, in a sense, because people had a perception that it's American fundamentalism and it's alien to our culture. And so we've been Christian since the 5th century. You know, why this modern American thing? And so being able to try to explain what are the theological and historical differences between, you know, Roman Catholicism and evangelical Christian. So I think you do have to bring in the historical element into that. And particularly in Ireland, where we have had a lot of, let's say, bad examples of sectarian conflict. And so people have a perception of Protestantism as a political entity rather than the theological reasons behind it, because pretty much all they have seen in Irish history is the political arm of the Protestant Church.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I hadn't thought about it from that. I mean, I've lived in the UK, as I said. I've been in Scotland, and I watched the Northern Ireland thing unfold from Scotland. In fact, you know, I had never been in a society that had been so impacted by sectarian conflict as when I was living in Scotland. I was there as a student in the late 70s and early 80s, and as a doctoral student. And what was interesting is that it was so sectarian that even the sports teams, the soccer teams, mm-hmm. were structured. There was in Scotland, there was a Catholic soccer team, mm-hmm. Celtic, and there was a Protestant soccer team, Rangers. Mm-hmm. And they had only, how can I say, desectarianized, I don't know if that's a word, but mm-hmm. they only crossed religious boundaries within 5 years of my coming over there, yeah. and that just seems so foreign to me, mm-hmm. to the Northern Ireland politics was big when I was in Scotland,
yeah.
And so living in a sectarian context where you see that kind of tension between Christian groups, as anyone knows who knows the history, it's an incredibly violent period, mm-hmm. in history. That kind of religious political mix, generally speaking, we don't find here. Mm-hmm. But that's changed because yeah. It's secularism now that
it has radically changed. And like the Republic of Ireland, where I'm from, there isn't any sectarian conflict because one side dominated, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah,
from the modern period on. So it's not really that there's two groups fighting. But like you said, I think, yeah, nominalism is really the sort of the worldview that's at work, mm-hmm. in Ireland as a whole, which is predominantly Roman Catholic. 84% of the people say they're Roman Catholic. The Catholic Church did a survey in 2010 where they surveyed Irish Roman Catholics, and 10% said they didn't believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So, I mean, there's still a large section of the population that identify themselves as Roman Catholic, but are effectively atheists.
Yeah.
And so that is a huge thing, much more than sectarianism. I think mm-hmm. that's the real battleground is impacting people that are comfortably Christian in a very cultural setting, but don't really have a relationship with Jesus.
Yeah.
So, and some don't even believe in God.
Yeah. So that and really that in many ways is the same cultural conversation that's starting to emerge in parts of the United States, where it's becoming so secularized that your Christian tag is more a cultural tag, yeah. than it is a substantive tag. Cesar, I imagine, though, in Latin America that there are issues that come up as a matter of course that most that don't hit the radar screen here. What would those
especially
be?
Especially the spiritual there is very real.
Uh-huh.
When I go to Venezuela, it's just like evil is present from the corruption in the government there, and it's widespread.
Mm-hmm.
But also Catholics, they will go to have their palm read. Mm-hmm. They'll go to horoscopes. So you'll see it on TV everywhere. So the spiritual is very real to people.
So it's almost the exact opposite, yes, of what's going on in Europe.
Exact opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that the battle will be more on a spiritual level. Then, yeah.
And what the other thing that I'm sharing out of my own experience in Guatemala, because this is one of the things that we did. I used to teach a class in which we took students from Dallas, and my friend took students from Denver Seminary, and we would combine them with the Latin American students down, and, mm-hmm. and we would do hermeneutics in the Bible, but we would do it in a different context. And the thing that we would ask our students to do is, what strikes you here about reading the Bible and what you would have to deal with that you wouldn't have to deal with if you were in the States? How is being here make you read the Bible differently, just simply being here? And the seminary in Guatemala was located literally 5 blocks from the garbage dump in Guatemala City, that literally we would do this class every 2 years. So you could as I would go down, I could watch it move, wow. across this valley. At one point, it was approaching us. At 1 year, it was with us, and the next year, it had gone beyond us. And so, that's the way garbage is. So, so you're watching this happen. But the thing that our students consistently said about at least many parts of Latin America, and I think you alluded to this, is the direct engagement with intense poverty that you often see in Latin America, and you said many of the Christians who are there do come out of the lower classes, so that if you're a pastor ministering in that context, you are encountering core life choices that you normally don't see in many churches here in the States. Is that fair?
It is very fair.
Yeah.
Yes. And this the wealth and the poverty coexist. Mm-hmm. They're side by
next side. Next by next. In fact, that's one of the things we used to do in Guatemala. We would take students into the poorest parts of Guatemala City, and we could go not 10 minutes, and you could be in a part of Guatemala City and you wouldn't know you were in Guatemala. Yes. I mean, you know, you would think you were in Europe or in the States. Mm-hmm. So you'd see it did very much exist side by side. So a lot of pastoral preparation has to help people cope with just the core basics of survival in life oftentimes. Is that true?
Exactly. And people sometimes don't have time to, like here in the U.S., you have time to reflect about theological matters. There you're focused on surviving every day, on feeding your kid every day. So you don't have much time to for theory. You need to practice. So the gospel there has to have a very practical side to.
Is that part of what you think drives the prosperity theology that
definitely,
goes on?
Definitely. Because they're offering these people things that are not real, that they'll become rich if they start they call it planting in the church, with like tithing. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they give beyond what they are able to give or what they should give, and they're not getting any better by doing that. So that's why this prosperity theology is so successful there.
Interesting. And what about the Philippines? What do you see there? What issues do you see there that you tend not to see here?
Well, first I want to say it's very similar in the Philippines also with the poverty and the rise of prosperity gospel in the Philippines. Very similar situation. One thing that I've noticed in the Philippines that we don't see here is an extreme, which is not necessarily a bad thing, it's an extreme commitment to holiness for the leaders, that leaders are held to a super high standard. Whereas coming back to the United States, I found it would be rare to see church discipline enacted in a church. Whereas in the Philippines, I was in a church where a leader sent an inappropriate text message to a woman, and that leader was disciplined and stepped down. He didn't even touch her. It was a text. And here in the United States, you know, far worse things than inappropriate text messages happen, and we don't see church discipline enacted as much. So there is a strong emphasis on holiness there.
Do you have any idea where that comes from at all?
I think because teachers are held to a higher standard, and in a culture where you have that power distinction between the laity, and they want to be able to look up to their leaders and say, these leaders are different than me.
So it comes from with the territory of how a leader is perceived to a certain degree, and so what's demanded of them. Interesting. Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and sharing a little bit about your country and your experience with us. You know, we've talked a little bit about issues that from a kind of global perspective. Let me have us close to have you each tell us what's one thing you think you could say about cultural engagement in light of your own background that you would want to emphasize to people who are listening in terms of thinking about how they engage the culture, and whether that has to do with how you do it as a Christian who might be in a minority context, which we're moving towards here, or something else. What one thing would you each like to say?
I think it's almost easier to engage as a minority because you have to engage from humility, and you have to engage from a vulnerability, in a sense, that you're not the dominant group that's setting the agenda. But I think Irish Christians, Irish evangelical Christians, I think they do a pretty good job of engaging the culture around them. They have moved past a stage that maybe earlier they had the inclination to completely cut themselves off from those things that were formerly their part of their life before conversion, so even sports or anything like that. But I think they've largely moved beyond that, and they see themselves as being able to engage with their fellow townspeople or, you know, their communities. But you have to engage from a position of humility because you are a minority. And I think that's effective, and it's healthy, and I think it's quite easy, to be honest.
So if I'm reading between the lines here, that one of the dangers of being a large number is the risk is that you'll minister out of a context of power and entitlement as opposed to out of a context of humility. Is that what you're what you're seeing?
Definitely.
Interesting. Mikhail?
I think I would say asking good questions, asking good questions with a tone of humility, recognizing that people come from all kinds of different backgrounds, and they may have religious backgrounds that you don't know about. They may appear to be, such as in the Philippines, one might appear to be a theist, a Christian, and really have an animistic worldview underneath all this, where when they say God, they may think of a faraway God that you can't touch, talk to, and you need intermediaries or spirits.
Some people here might even know it and may have a clue what you're talking about. talking about when you say animism. What would that involve?
In the Philippines, we have a specific form called anatism, mm-hmm. which means that Filipinos would view God as a faraway deity who doesn't really help you, is too busy to appeal to. Mm-hmm. So instead, you appeal to intermediary spirits, be mm-hmm. they spirits of animals, nature spirits, or your own dead relatives. Mm-hmm. Now, Roman Catholic tradition, when that came to the Philippines, saints had replaced those intermediate mm-hmm. states between God and human beings, mm-hmm. so that people would appeal to specific saints for specific things that they need.
So there is an element of ancestor connection, because you do find this very much in other places in Asia. In fact, it's one of the big issues that Christians face once they become a Christian in relationship mm-hmm. to their families, is mm-hmm. how do I deal with this element of family expectations, and that goes on in the Philippines.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's an issue that we don't think about very much here in the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, more and more immigrants coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. I was in Southern California. We worked with the Vietnamese mm-hmm. immigrants, and knowing that everybody comes from a certain cultural background, and Christians struggle with different things. And we talked about sacrificing food to idols in Bible mm-hmm. study and youth group. It was not a metaphorical thing. Mm-hmm. They're literally, you know, I go to my friend's house, they sacrifice the food to the ancestors. Mm-hmm. Now what do I do? So very real things like that. So mm-hmm. to find out where the audience that you're working with is coming from, and then engage them, you know, understanding where they are coming from and the struggles they have.
Mm-hmm. And Cesar, what would you say?
Well, I would encourage the church, people in the church in America, to be more open, especially to foreigners, since there are so many foreigners coming to this country. Mm-hmm. And as an example, my wife is in a small group, and she felt that the ladies there, they would share very, very superficial things, and next thing you know, one of them is just getting a divorce. So mm-hmm. so people are not opening up their problems in this context. So I would encourage them to open up in their small groups, to really share from a deeper level, as we do in South America. Being a minority, you depend on your new family of Christians, so everybody really knows how you're doing. When you ask people how you're doing, you really mean it. Mm-hmm. You really want to know how they're doing. So to not be so superficial here.
Interesting. Well, again, I thank you for coming in and taking the time to do this. I hope this has been, it's been interesting for me, I mean, to hear stories from three countries, some of which I've known mm-hmm. sort of up close, and then others very much from a distance, and hear the different kinds of Christian experiences and what that means for you in your own experiences. You think about engagement and think about your own Christian development, and I think sometimes it is helpful for us to kind of step outside our own box and hear from people who have lived in this fishbowl all their life and see, and they say, oh, so that's what the aquarium looks like.
Yeah.
So I very much appreciate it. And we thank you all for coming to the table again, and look forward to seeing you again next time.
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.